Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast. In this episode, we talk about the evolution of the Gigabyte overclocking motherboard line, and Darren and I talk about a change in the overclocking competitions. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia. With me today, I have Darren McCain. Darren, I've been reviewing motherboards for quite a long time. It's one of the passions I have here at Hardware Asylum and even at Ninja Lane before. And I've noticed that over the years, motherboard design has changed from, you know, the bare bones style from the Soltec boards that I used early on to even the DFI LAN party boards that were specialized. And now we have, you know, the Rampage boards from ASUS. And they all have kind of a different feel to them.
So you're not talking just like the new chipsets and that sort of thing then?
No, we're talking about what makes every board unique and how it's designed to help certain aspects of the segment. You know, we have like gaming boards, we have overclocking boards, we have cheap boards, for the lack of another term.
Right. Now, I notice you've got a stack, a rogues gallery, if you will, of motherboards out. Looks like starting with, is that an X58?
That is. We are looking at right now, and I'll post a picture in the show notes, but we have basically every OC board that Gigabyte has made that's been specially designed for overclocking.
Now, this is not including the unicorns of the world then. These are the ones you and I could purchase on the market?
Exactly. So the first one is the X58A OC, and this is the board that started the overclock phenomenon, I should say, within Gigabyte.
So the actual X58A-OC was the first attempt at an overclocking motherboard for them then? Well, or at least the first mainstream attempt.
Yeah, it was the first special built, and this was and this was a board that their internal overclocker, High Cookie, helped spearhead.
I grab it here.
Okay. And while he gets that, High Cookie has been a driving force within Gigabyte to build overclocking boards and boards that are easy to overclock, I should say, or make it a more pleasant experience, I should say.
So it's interesting looking at the packaging, some of the stuff that we take for granted these days that is getting advertised on here.
Such as what with DC?
Well, like the onboard overclocking buttons, the power buttons, and the plus and minus for the voltage, and the infamous 4G button.
The 4 gigahertz button. Yeah, and on X58, 4 gigahertz was kind of the magical number, and it was really easily attainable from just about every processor you could put on there. And I've overclocked with this board. I've gotten a Gulftown 980X up to 6 gigahertz with it on liquid nitrogen.
Nice.
Some of the features of it was that they allow it a lot of room around the CPU socket to easily insulate in any style that you like. So if you wanted to use liquid tape, you could put it on there. If you wanted to use kneaded eraser, it was easy to remove. With Vaseline, a lot of the areas on there were easily accessible. They used the flat style capacitor, so you didn't have to worry about water getting underneath them. It was one of those boards that they, from the ground up, they decided, well, we're going to focus on overclocking with this. And unfortunately, the board was released late in the generation. This was like one of the last X58 boards to come out until the new chipset. And it was also one of those that the salespeople within Gigabyte had a hard time marketing because they didn't know how.
Interesting. See, nowadays, this would be a very desirable board just from the feature set.
Well, exactly. And it was one of those, it didn't have like a fancy sound card on it. You know, it's just like three channels, I think. I think it had just one Ethernet port.
Yeah, and not even a lot of USB on here. And of course, this is one of the early USB 3.0 boards too.
Right. But it did have lights. The Southbridge chipset was lit up.
I like lights, and it is pretty too. This is one of the early ones that had that really beautiful contrasting kind of orange and black theme to it that has been so prevalent from Gigabyte.
Well, lately it has been.
Well, that's
before,
true.
Before that, the orange and black was a famous color from DFI.
Oh, good old DFI, yeah.
All of their Intel boards were orange and black, but the orange was also... it'd shine under the black light.
Now, you mentioned that this one came out fairly late, but what kind of impact on the market did it have?
I want to say that Gigabyte thinks that it had a huge impact on the market. And it got a lot of overclockers really interested in overclocking specialized motherboard sort of designs. It was one of those things where it changed the focus of overclocking boards. But in terms of market share, this was somewhat limited edition. They didn't make a lot of them. And since the salespeople had a hard time selling them, they didn't really fly off the shelves. And all of the performance hardware that you could buy, like faster memory, DDR, you know, triple kits for DDR3, were hard to get. The 980Xs were actually fairly prevalent, but they were still $1,000. So there was kind of a strange juxtaposition in the market.
So I'm looking at the next one in line you've got here, the X79UD7, and I see the overclock symbol on it, but it's not OC in the name.
Right. This was, the OC was still very new, and at the time, Gigabyte was focused on the ultra durable series.
Oh, yes, the UDs.
Yeah, so everything that was UD7, they also had a UD9. Those were the ultra high end. So they made this overclock board, but then they called it the UD7 to keep within the marketing spiel that they created.
Right. Now, looking at this motherboard, it looks more like a mainstream motherboard. You got more features, more output, and a lot less heat sink.
Right. And that was one of the downfalls of this particular board, because the X79 suffered from an overheated VRM.
Oh.
So you needed to keep the VRM cool to be able to overclock and keep the board stable. Of course, under LN2, that wasn't really that big of an issue, but if you were water cooling it, or if you had a tower-style heatsink, you needed to put another fan in there to make sure it stayed cool.
And from a chipset perspective, this was the big jump to the LGA 2011 processors.
Mm-hmm.
So a big jump in performance, too. Yeah.
And it was also a board that they focused a lot more effort on the VRM. And sadly enough, this is one of the boards that, unless you had a high current power supply, it wouldn't start the board.
Oh, wow.
It would actually trip the OCP and it just wouldn't power on.
That's interesting. That couldn't have helped on the market.
No, it wasn't a very popular design. And I want to say that probably a month after it came out, and I got one of the first review samples. I had trouble with it because of my processor. So I sent it back and then I reviewed a UD3 in place of it. And I had to battle to get the UD7 back because they were all either sold, accounted for, and they weren't making any more of them.
One thing I noticed looking at the packaging is they are advertising 3D power, and this one supports 4-Y Crossfire and 4-Way SLI.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a benefit of the X79 and the new Sandy Bridge E processors. They had a lot more PCI Express lanes, so you could run 4-Way on these particular boards. The 3D power and the 3D BIOS was a new BIOS implementation that gave them more control over like the VRMs, and also you had pictures of the board and you could just click on it and then change a feature.
Oh, nice. Mouse friendly and everything.
Kind of. It wasn't very implemented very well, I don't think.
So what kind of performance did you get on this one? Do you recall?
I didn't use this board very much because of the aforementioned power supply problems, but I was able to basically overclock my Sandy Bridge E, my 3960X, as high on this board as I was able to on any of the other boards I had reviewed. So I was able to max it out, and that was the important thing.
Well, I see the next one is a Z77X. So normally I would expect the numbers to climb, but from X79 to Z77, UP7, is that right?
Yep, and the UP stands for Ultra Power. They during this era, they were playing with a new MOSFET design, which they've since used on all the boards forward. And with this one, they're using one of the lower-end ones, but they basically doubled and almost tripled the VRM size. And that's what the UP stands for, is Ultra Power.
Well, I see, looks like a bazillion phases here, 32 plus 3 plus 2.
Yeah, it was very impressive in terms of how many power phases you could have on there. Totally overkill. I mean, you don't need that much for an LGA 1156 socket or 55 socket.
And just in general, I mean, I'm seeing all kinds of crazy overkill. 7 fan connectors. What do you got? 3D power again with... Is that 3 PWM A, B, and C? Wow.
I want to say this particular board was designed to compete with like the Maximus from Asus. And, you know, some Asus has been very famous in their ROG line to include everything and then some on their motherboards, basically combine everything they possibly can, give you as much features, as much expandability as they can within reason, right? Well, Gigabyte typically didn't do that all on one board. They would have different segments. So you'd have a high-end board like a UD7 that would have a lot of features, but it wouldn't have everything. You know, the UD5 might be the mainstream one, the one that they wanted to market to everybody. That came with a few more features, but then a smaller VRM to keep the cost down or something like that. So,
well, this is another motherboard that prominently features the OC symbolism, but it doesn't have it in the name.
No, it has the orange and black color theme. It also supports four-way graphics, which means it has a PLX chip on board. It's got the nice large heatsink to keep the VRM cool and the PLX, which is probably the hottest chip on the board. They hadn't really adopted the OC line. Again, I believe the trouble with getting sales on board to be able to sell these boards was the biggest challenge.
Well, and this one has all the bells and whistles. I mean, you got Bluetooth, dual, Wi-Fi, the whole nine yards. So this one really covered all the bases.
Yep. And unfortunately, a lot like the X79, this particular board made waves for about 3 or 4 months, and then it became increasingly more difficult to find, which means it was limited edition again.
Well, I imagine that this one was a fairly expensive board with all the different checkboxes there.
Yep. And that's one reason why they don't do those sometimes. But that's also kind of brings up another point in that, you know, Gigabyte kind of end-of-lifes their boards a lot faster than some of the other manufacturers, but they also make more of them, so it kind of makes sense.
Well, the box is very large, I imagine, with all the extra accessories, but the next one that you've brought out, the Z87XOC, is a tiny box.
Yeah, very, very tiny box. And this is going to be the first board that they released after the X58A that features the OC in the name. And the one that Darren has in his hand now, which nobody can see because this is a podcast, is the very affordable 2D overclocking motherboard.
It's just little.
It's just stinky. Well, there's not a lot that comes with the board.
Well, it does say four-way crossfire, two-way SLI.
Right, and that is a technology limitation because NVIDIA requires that you have like 8 lanes of PCI Express to activate SLI, which means you have to have a PLX chip on these lower-end processors. But with Crossfire, you're able to do that all the way down to, what is it, 2 lanes or something like that.
Well, this is so much smaller, but I do see it's still a pretty full-featured board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got the HDMI, you got 10 USB ports, full 8-channel HD audio, and then you still have all your on-the-fly OC onboard buttons.
Yeah, those are one of the... the love or hate sort of features on these OC boards.
Well, I see they've replaced the 4G button with a OC ignition button on this particular model.
Yeah, and I'm probably going to get this wrong, but the OC ignition is a, it's not an auto overclocking, but it's probably, I think it disables like a memory channel or something stupid like that.
Interesting. And a nice brace for your video cards, which is a feature that we don't see often enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the OC brace, that is in my reviews, I would famously say that these were going to be like black market items. So the people that put these boards in a case and they don't use the OC brace will go and sell it on eBay, and then an overclocker will grab it because you can use it.
Yeah,
you just put it on the bench and you lock it down and you have perfect card retention.
That's slick. So this one, again, a small board, but it still performed well, I take it.
Yeah, this was the board that landed a lot of overclocking records, primarily in memory and 2D performance. The interesting thing here is, unlike the UP7 that we just looked at that had 32 power phases, this one has, dun-dun-dun, 8.
8. That's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just that much more efficient?
The MOSFETs are considerably more efficient, but you don't need more than like 4 to run these new Sandy and Ivy Bridge processors. Putting any more than that on there is more of a show-off.
I believe it. Now, with that in mind, I see that you have what to me looks like a nearly identical Z87XOC Force, which is the same 1150 socket design, but a much bigger, fancier package.
Yes.
Let me grab that one.
There was two boards released during this era. She mentioned that the board that we just looked at sold for like close to $200. Really inexpensive for a full-featured motherboard.
Yeah, that is cheap.
The Z87X OC Force was the version that supported four-way SLI.
So it looks a lot similar, the board design, with the exception of, what is that, a water cooling built in?
Yeah, the MOSFET cooler had water cooling, a water cooling line. This was the ultra high-end board that was designed for enthusiasts that are building their own systems and want to get the most out of it. Incidentally, the layout of the OC Force mimics the UP7 in terms of like slot layout, MOSFET design. I mean, there was less MOSFETs on here, obviously, but the MOSFET design was the same. Heatsink placement was the same. Component placement was almost the same. It was like they kind of borrowed the design, updated it for the chip, which is the inexpensive way to do it. Yeah, with the Force, four-way SLI support, it came with a lot more included features. And, you know, the water-cooled MOSFET cooler, name it, it's probably on there.
What do they call this thing? Dual water silent fan. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, yeah, there's a fan on there, too. You can't see it in the picture, but it's in the back.
Oh, yeah, on the back one. But this one has the OC brace. Still has more of the bells and whistles like that X79 that we looked at.
Yeah. Incidentally, they had a Z87 that was also a G1 board. The layout was almost identical, except that instead of being orange, it was green.
Now, one of the interesting things about this one is it has a front access panel breakout, but it also has the OC brace and, wow, dual Wi-Fi cards. So they really were throwing a full-featured board at you. So from a market standpoint, was this a more successful board or more readily available?
It was less available because it was an expensive board. It was also expensive to make. It probably had the same life as a UP7, but the previous board, the regular OC, that was available in the market for almost ever. I mean, I think you can still buy them.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed over the last couple motherboards we've talked about is that they have a reliance on a much more ultra durable is maybe a right word, copper PCB. So we're seeing multi-layer with a heavier amount of copper in them too. So the durability of the board itself is much stronger also.
The boards get a little thicker later on in the generations. The ultra durable package, I believe is what Gigabyte calls it. It's basically a chunk of parts that they always put into all the boards. It doesn't necessarily make it more durable, but the quality of the components is higher.
Well, I would believe you'd need that for your high-ends. I noticed they advertising the durable high-end capacitors on these. This is, and maybe I haven't noticed before, but this is the first one where I've noticed has a specific OC peg. It looks like a whole suite of manual switches for the BIOS and such.
The previous board had that as well. The layout of the buttons was different, but physically all the same buttons were there. And those buttons, they changed the switch style.
Ah, okay.
Because on the UP7, they were big round ones. Oh. And they didn't have quite as many.
Well, it's definitely taken up less space also.
Mm-hmm.
But this one here looks like the organization was, you know, purpose-built more so than the last couple.
Right. And again, it mimics the UP7 design. And I want to say they just, you know, they spent a lot of time designing this full-featured board. We're going to borrow this and update it. Change some things around and try to make it a little bit less expensive.
So then this is LGA 1150, like I already mentioned. So the next step takes us to the Z97 series.
Yeah, let me grab that since it's on the other side of the table.
Okay.
Now, this board, they changed the name a bit. This is the Z97X SOC Force.
So what's the S?
The S is something that was borrowed from video card land over at Gigabyte. Some people may not know this. Gigabyte Motherboard and Gigabyte VGA are completely separate divisions within the Gigabyte umbrella.
I'd never guess.
And they famously don't allow cross-marketing with the Z97, which is basically a refresh chipset because it supports the new Devil's Canyon and whatnot. They started working together. So the SOC was always a monger that was added to the ultra high-end video cards.
Oh.
That was super overclock, as we'd have
said. Oh, that's right.
So now they're using the SoC on the motherboards. And on the gaming boards, they started borrowing the Gigabyte Eye, the Aorus Eye, and putting that on the logos.
So and that looks good. And this is a complete redesign of the package to support some of the things that we used to laugh about that are now standard, like the killer gaming network, for example.
Yeah, they started adding a lot more overclocking friendly features, like the killer NIC. And in a lot of my reviews, you know, I test games against boards that have the killer NIC versus not the killer NIC. And you always get higher frame rates. And that's because the CPU doesn't have to dedicate as much time to work with network traffic. It can just offload it to one of these chips.
Oh, well, yeah,
it also works for overclocking.
Well, and I see they've also got a separate sound circuit that's been isolated and the whole nine yards.
Yeah, so I'm bringing out the Z87X OC. Now, if you look at the board layout, I think you'll see a few similarities.
Yeah, now you mentioned it, I do. In fact, the picture is nearly identical.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of chipset evolution, you know, it's a refresh chip, but they just kind of adapted it to the board. Under the surface, they changed the BIOS a bit because it's a UEFI BIOS. Right. They changed that to include a couple of new screens, mostly just kind of to address different segments that might be using the board, like the people that are just putting it in the system and want to make sure that their hard drive works. They have a screen for that. And then they also have a dedicated screen for overclocking and building your own custom dashboards of the stuff you want to see. And then you have the nuts and bolts advanced that will allow you to micro-tune everything.
So this one, I mean, the major difference really seems to be the add-ons and of course, the chipset.
Yeah. So at this point, I believe that the designers have come up with a layout that they really like, something that works, and they've just started improving on it.
Well, that makes sense. And that goes back to your evolutionary content, where you're really just building on the previous design.
Yeah. Now, the one board that kind of stands out as being completely different is the next one, and that's the latest one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we are looking at the X99 version of the SoC, which is the SoC Force.
Yeah. This is the X99 stands for the latest chipset revision for LGA 2011-3.
So the layout is, of course, the first thing I look at, and it's still very similar.
Yeah, we have quad-channel memory, so that's going to be the biggest difference. The VRM is across the top, a lot like the UD7 that we had looked at earlier. Supports four-way SLI and crossfire based off of the more PCI Express lanes in the processor. It still has all of the overclocking buttons to help with 2D overclocking, which I believe, you know, the LGA 2011 has always been a 3D chipset. Processors before have always been performance limited, so, you know, they would top out at like 5.2, 5.5 gigahertz. But they worked really, really well for overclocking video cards. They were very stable. You could run them just kind of like on a water cooler at 5 gigahertz a lot of times. So they were very stable, and you could spend more time overclocking your video card and less time worrying about tending the CPU pot.
And this one seems to further the theme of isolating the additional chipsets for things like the audio with additional shielding and moving them further away from the chipsets.
Mm-hmm. And it also comes with SATA Express, which is a new chipset feature. So a lot of the additions to any motherboard, any generational motherboard, is what the chipset supports. The other items like the killer NIC and the upgraded audio, that's something that the manufacturer of the board can decide to put on the board or not put on the board because it adds cost. But if they don't include a chipset feature, then they usually get shunned in the marketplace because, you know, you're looking for a board with SATA Express, even though you can't buy a drive.
Yeah.
You want that feature.
Well, you want to be future-proof a little bit, especially at the cost of some of these motherboards. And right now, the cost of the chipset for the processor is substantial also. So you definitely want these things to last a little longer than they usually do.
Now, one thing that we haven't talked about that is on the X99, the Z97X, that wasn't on the previous boards and even on some of the competitor boards, they started doing a surface mount memory slot.
Okay.
So, you know, traditionally the memory socket, the pins for the socket go all the way through the PCB and then they're solder bathed onto the back of the board.
Yeah.
Well, when you're overclocking, you always insulate the back of the board. That's something that you always have to do. But if you got water on the memory socket, then of course it would short out the memory and your overclock would be hindered or it'd blow up the board. Well, with the surface mount technology, they were able to clean up the signal integrity from the CPU to the memory socket and also eliminate any condensation issues with the memory.
Well, that's nice.
And that's something that you don't necessarily see on these boards, but they're only on the OC boards as far as I know.
Wow, and that's a nice feature, especially when you're doing the competitive overclocking.
Mm-hmm. It just helps clean it up.
Now, there are a lot of advantages, of course, to the new chipset, and that primarily be the DDR4. But what are you seeing out of this latest version, the X99 SoC Force?
A lot of potential for overclocking. Now, the final evolution of these boards is something that we saw with Z97 was an LN2 board, and that was designed specifically for memory overclocking. Now, these boards are all kind of special built. Like, we have ones that are 2D benchmarks only. We have 3D benchmarks only. Well, we have the specialization of memory overclocking, which is kind of the latest thing with the Haswell chips. So what they did is they moved the memory sockets closer to the CPU and then basically took away the heatsink mounting points. So you have to use a special LN2 bench to keep the cooler on there. That's been setting a lot of memory records, but it's like a unicorn board, so it's really hard to find. The latest chatter, which by the time that you listen to this podcast, it still won't be of release, but there's a X99 SoC Champion board rumored to be floating
Champion.
Around.
Champion, well, that's a pretty impressive title.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's another unicorn board, but it's going to be styled after the LN2 boards that we saw on the Z97. So it's probably going to be specialized 2D benchmarking. It might even be small, you know, like mini ITX sized. I haven't seen any pictures yet, so we're kind of speculating. But again, specialized evolution of motherboards to react to something that's happening in the enthusiast community.
Well, something to look forward to, and I'm sure that the evolution continues. Dennis, this week you published, I think, a really good article on potential changes to, I guess, overclocking competitions, and in particular, ways to remove the bin from the occasions or from the equation.
From the equation, yes. One thing I've noticed in a lot of the overclocking competitions that I have attended is that the overclocker with the best processor usually wins.
Well, we've talked about that before, that the deep pockets required to compete because you need to have a lot of hardware.
Well, and that's particularly true in the online competition, like the MOA qualifier that I famously had said that I competed in. You know, one year I bought three Sandy Bridge E processors.
Ouch.
Yeah. And that sent me back quite a bit. I also paid a lot of extra money to get a Z97 MSI motherboard that came with a video card that I sold, and then I had to hunt around to try to find a Lightning card that I could use because I didn't want to necessarily have to modify a standard 7970 to put a bigger VRM on it and stuff like that.
And the root of all this is simply just to find, through binning, the best possible hardware.
Yes, so that you can get the best possible overclock. The same is true for like gaming. If you want to have just a casual overclock in your game, you always find a video card that is either specially designed for this or has a really good ASIC number, which is the quality of the chip, because usually you can bump the factory overclock a bit and still remain stable and remain relatively cool in terms of, you know, because overclocking adds heat, right? The higher the quality of the chip, the less voltage you need to feed into it, the more power you can get out of it.
Well, and that brings the cooling method into play a little bit. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about specifically is how could you minimize or remove completely the deep pocket or bin advantage?
Right. And that is mostly going to play into live overclocking competitions because the online one is kind of a bigger issue with people that fudge the rules and kind of like, share hardware and don't tell anyone. You know, there's a lot of nuances with online competition that isn't necessarily the case with live competition.
We have a lot more control over the live because it's happening in a controlled environment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. The environment is controlled. And by, again, the best overclocker usually wins, and that's the whole idea of these overclocking competitions. But we have, you know, 19 of the best overclockers based on the qualifying rounds, and, you know, who have spent a lot of money binning, a lot of time overclocking.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I've noticed that the cast of characters is very repetitive.
Yes.
And to some extent, based a little bit on the hardware and a little bit on what overclocks are being used, you can almost predict who your top finishers are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is due to the binning.
Some of it's to the binning. Some of it is to experience. But, you know, we have, you know, at MOA, for instance, this last one that I just attended, I was talking to some of the overclockers saying, so how's it going? You know, how's your hardware? And they go, well, my chip sucks.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that's a binning problem. And supposedly these chips are pre-tested before the event so that they all are capable of a certain overclock or all are capable of a certain voltage point. So the idea is that they all have an equal chip.
Well, at least as equal as you can find.
Right. And, you know, the comment saying, well, my chip sucks or my chip doesn't work or my board is fried. You know, some of that is the way they set up the system or that they are accustomed to a higher quality chip because through their binning on their own, that, you know, they're expecting a certain score and they're not getting it because the chip that they were given isn't
capable.
Right.
So you had talked to me a little bit about ways that you could remove the deep pockets or the bin from the equation.
Yeah.
And in your article, you discussed, I think golf was your example. You want to recap that for us?
Yeah. So that the way that I was proposing a change to live overclocking was to remove the fact that the fastest person wins and make it more of a game. The game aspect would be like a Dota match where we have groups of people competing against each other. And I was using golf as an analogy because we have the course, which is basically the competition. We have the player, who is the human element, and that's what we need for a sport. And then we have the equipment that they use, and their practice playing the course using the equipment that they're given allows them to better themselves or get a par score or an eagle score or, you know, a bogey score. And if they screw up, then they suffer by losing a stroke. So with my taking that and applying it to overclocking, I proposed that, you know, say for instance, we're doing SuperPi 32M, we give target scores and we give multiples of target scores. So we might have five targets that the overclocker has to hit within, say, a 2-hour time frame. And by limiting it by 2 hours and using 32M, we can determine that they would have to run, they might be able to run each segment twice before they would have to move on to the next one.
Well, couldn't you, you know, just build like a spreadsheet of voltage combinations or something like that?
Mm-hmm. You could. And that's where practice comes in. If they allowed them to bring notes in, they could just have their notebook and they could figure out, oh, I have to run 5 gigahertz with 2300 megahertz on the memory to get close to this target score. But unless you know how to prep your system to run that overclock for that amount of time, you know, under liquid nitrogen or whatever, and be able to set up the OS so that there isn't any variances, that's where skill comes in. So at this point, you're still having to reach a target score, which is calculatable. But there's variances within the system and being able to prep the system that change the variables a little bit. And if you know how to set it up, you can get a consistent score each time. But if you if you don't do a WASA on 32M to, you know, start it at the very beginning of the memory sequence or whatever, however WASA works, I've never been able to successfully use that. You know, WASA allows you to get the fastest score possible, but it's also the most consistent method. So if you do it right, then you can get a consistent score.
So you're using golf as an analogy, and I know that a more popular, at least in the overclocking community, is the racing aspect of, you'll hear drag racing from the Americans and F1 from the Europeans, for example. But most of the time,
it's the fastest person wins.
Right. Or to use the drag race example, the fastest achievable time in the overclock. And that's a completely different train of thought because you're talking about hitting a specific target or like a par in golf.
Right. Or if you really wanted to use a drag race analogy, it's bracket racing. And we've all seen bracket racing where you set a time and then, at least in drag racing, you set a time. And then when you compete against the competitor next to you, you have to get to the end of the track without breaking out of your time and still beating the other person.
Oh, so we're talking consistency then from that particular aspect. And that makes sense.
Yeah. Going on with the competition, the five scores, each one of the runs gives you a certain amount of points based on how close to the target you get. Because obviously you're not going to get the perfect score each time. That would be an albatross or an eagle, right?
Right.
Say, for instance, the variance is 10 seconds for 10 points, 20 seconds for 9 points, so on and so forth. So you might get 9 points in the first run, 10 points in the second run because you got a perfect, and then 2 points in the next one because you screwed up, and then 4 points because you got a little bit better. But then you ran out of time and you weren't able to finish the fifth run. Well, the next team or the next person, maybe they had 4, 4, 2, 6, 2, 7. They were able to finish the last one, so they actually got more points. So there's a strategy involved. You can try to reach your target score in the time frame and then get as much points as possible. Or you can try to get as much points by just submitting a score, and getting to the very end.
Okay.
So that is like one aspect, and that I call that one closest to the pin. Now, by changing this, we also change the way that the game is played. So we can do and I believe you suggested this one, it's called Race 2.
Oh, yeah, because that's popular in a lot of different ways in sports. Mm-hmm. And that being that you have so many points, for example, a best of 7 or best of 5 or even a best of 3, and you hit that point and then you see who gets that best of however many it would be first.
Mm-hmm. So, and the way I translated that into the overclock competition was that we had, it was a group competition. So we famously, maybe we have MSI competing against ASUS.
Now that'd be something to see, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Each team is allowed 5 competitors on each side. They're given a target score of Super Pi, like 5 minutes flat. You have to reach 5 minutes flat. All 5 competitors can try to reach the score so they can actually spread out their scores at this point, right? Some person can run a high overclock with low memory and, you know, strategy involved, right?
So I'm assuming there'd be like some plus or minus maybe or an acceptable variance to hit that point.
Right. And obviously, since there's more people competing, the variance would get a lot smaller. The first person to get a score that matches that would get the point. And then they are given another score and then they reset and they start again. And then the first team to the race two number wins.
So it's a race to see who gets that advantage. Mm-hmm. And I like that. But the main reason that I like that is something that you've kind of alluded to but haven't specifically mentioned, and that is that you're eliminating the hardware dependence that we see in so many competitions. So you could allow people to come in with their own gear if they were deep-pocketed, or sponsors could send their teams with all MSI gear or all ASUS gear, for example. Mm-hmm. And we'd actually get some manufacturer bragging rights for being whoever was the top seated or top manufacturer at one of these things, as opposed to everybody having to use the same gear.
Exactly. And like the Race 2 example, for instance, we have MSI competing against ASUS. Well, on the MSI side, it's all MSI hardware. On the ASUS side, it's all ASUS hardware. And that could be supplied by the companies being represented there.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you used a closest to the pin in a MOA situation, MSI might be sponsoring the competition, but then the competitors, and this is something I mentioned in the article, the competitors would have to bring their own gear, and then they would have to also pay to get to the competition. The payout might actually be higher, like in the range of like $125,000.
Well, that's certainly worth traveling, especially if you're a sponsor and overclocker.
Yeah, but at that point, you might have one person benching ASRock, one person benching ASUS, one person benching MSI. Of course, MSI could say, well, we want to have people using our gear, and then they have to dictate, well, you have to bring an MSI board, or you might have to bring or use a lightning card that they provide. or you buy one off the shelf. But at that point, you could pretty much pick up any one of those as long as you're familiar with it, because the bin shouldn't be a problem.
Right. And even if it is, you can adjust if you have the talent or the experience or even the right practice.
Yeah. And, you know, if you bring your own gear, it's already pre-binned. But the fact that you have like a golden Haswell chip isn't going to play into the competition, because you may not be running clocks that that chip is capable of.
Well, ideally, you'd want a target number that is achievable by everything that's in the hardware bracket.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even have to be like reach 4 minutes in SuperPi 32M. It could be something like, we want you to run a 7 minute 32M. Now you're going to have to downclock your system.
Oh, that's pretty radical.
Yeah. So it doesn't have to be overclocking. Another aspect of it is, you know, the rally style. And this was the third aspect that I had in there, where once you reach the end of a stage, which might be the end of a benchmark, you submit your score and that's what you have. And then you are given another task. So it may not be SuperPi 32M. It might be we're switching over to Cinebench. And at this point, you have to maintain, however you have your setup, your system set up, you have to maintain that throughout the entire competition. And, you know, if there's 20 stages, then how you insulate your system is going to become an issue. How you, if you have to keep your system cold throughout the entire time, you have to make sure you maintain that.
Oh, I see. So not necessarily just a rally, but more of an endurance race.
Yeah.
Where you're trying to see how many overclocks you can achieve in a given time period.
Mm-hmm.
I like that also, because it lends that that frantic nature of a race where you have to make a decision on how close you want to be to a clock before you take that next stage. Instead of getting maybe 100% in every phase, you might say, oh, well, I'm really good at Cinebench, so I can sacrifice and not get quite as many points in my, you know, stage of, you know, Firestrike.
Yeah, there's it opens up a lot of opportunities in terms of, like, you know, strategy involved, the types of benchmarks you use, how good the overclocker is, how long they've practiced. It also allows manufacturers to start to use overclockers in their marketing. Say, well, 8-Pack got first place in this competition and he used our gear. At that point, it's about the overclockers, not about the hardware so much.
And then the sponsorship becomes more like in regular sports, where you could be sponsored maybe individually by two or three manufacturers. I might have a video card sponsor that's different from my motherboard sponsor.
Yeah.
You know, and allows the manufacturers to share the wealth a little bit.
It also makes the manufacturer spend more time building high-end products that they can market to Joe Schmo. That's like, hey, we saw 8-Pack win this competition using this motherboard. I want to use that board.
Absolutely. And if you use achievable numbers, you could go back and use what we like to call classic hardware that's no longer the cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
So I might have a competition that's only open to, you know, Sandy Bridge processors.
Right. Say, for instance, and I saw this at MOA during the freestyle at the very end, some overclockers were running two-way, three-way, four-way video card setups. Well, you need to use a Z97 or an X99 for that. But then they were also doing two-day benchmarks. So you could have a competition where you run a SuperPi, you need to have an 1155 Haswell to get the best score, the score that needs to be attainable. Now you're switching over to Firestrike, and I'm going to run two-way SLI. Well, do I keep with the Haswell system, or do I pick my system up and then drop in an X99 to get a more consistent score?
Oh, interesting. So yeah, you might do different stages with different setups or even try to reconfigure your system on the fly. That would definitely be exciting to see live.
Yeah. And that probably brings up the last and most important point. The one major reason that overclocking is not mainstream like esports gaming, for instance, is because it's boring to watch. And by introducing some variances and making it more of a game, the media has something to write about. Live streamers have something that they can watch. Speculators have something that they can speculate about. It adds more interest to the sport and it allows you a reason to watch.
Well, and I think it also lets you focus more on the individual people that are competing than necessarily what's the hot hardware. Although that could also be the opposite.
It could be. And that is something that our listeners are going to have to let us know what they think about. You can find us on hardwaresound.com. For For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes on hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS, now available on iTunes. Join us on Facebook or follow us on Google. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2014. Thanks for listening.